MadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Tuesday, July 17th, 2012, and this is podcast number 170. We're going to go, for the first segment of the podcast, we're going to go back to Porkfest 2012, and you're going to hear, for the first 20 minutes of the show, you're going to hear an interview with a gentleman named Patrick that's from Scotland, and he was there at Porkfest 2012. And the audio is a little weird because it was recorded outside. I had to play with this, with the audio a little bit to get it so that you could actually understand what was going on. So it has a little bit of a metallic sound, but this is the best we can do for considering it was being recorded outside in the middle of Porkfest. So here we go. This is Patrick from Scotland.
And we're back at BadQuaker.com podcast at the New Hampshire Porcupine Freedom Festival 2012, the official name of Porkfest 2012. And I'm Ben Stone, and with me is, holy cow, Patrick. See?
Brain. Everything.
Yeah. With me is Patrick. Patrick is from Scotland. He came all the way here to New Hampshire specifically for Porkfest. And first off, I'm sure I'm not the first one that's told you, but welcome to North America. Welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you,
welcome,
sir,
to Porkfest. And, and this is your second year.
This is my second year, yeah. Came for the first time last year. I had a real blast, and I couldn't wait to come back.
What would possess a person the first time to come all the way that distance and expense and hassle and dealing with, you know, the intrusive security and all that?
Well, that's an interesting story, I suppose. In Europe, we're raised to be social democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So it required some free thought. I started investing in about 2006, which turned me into the gold and silver community.
Mm-hmm.
I was very worried about outstanding derivatives. Like, there have been like horror stories in the news about the kind of derivatives market and how that might impact financial markets. So I really wanted to start understanding that myself. And then that led into the monetary system, which then led me into gold and silver, which then led me into libertarianism, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, since about 07, 08, I've been hooked. Guys like Doug Casey, David Morgan put me on to people like Murray Rothbard and then David Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just something that I found fascinating. And certainly throughout history, the best parts of British history, in my opinion, were when we followed libertarian principles.
Uh-huh.
And like, those are the parts to be proud of, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So yeah, so through the internet, I had a YouTube channel for quite a while, and through that I formed friends, and I got into Stefan Molyneux, who then told me about Porkfest. It took me a couple of years to muster up the courage to finally come down, but you know, 2011, it was a real blast last time, and I'm having a lot of fun this time, too.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Have you got to go to the different events and listen to the speakers and so forth?
Yeah, I've just come from Danny D'Amico. His talk was entitled Examples of Previous Stateless Societies or something.
Oh, yeah,
like that.
I wanted to hear that.
It was excellent. I really enjoy talking to Danny. I find him one of the most interesting people here. Generally, I mean, he started off with a title, but just kept talking and talking and talking. He threw in all these really interesting examples of kind of conflict resolution in ancient Greece and like how we might kind of handle restitution in the modern day period and the failings in the prison system, and, you know, how we might use like examples from the past to help form our future.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was really enjoyable. Also, that I found the polyamory talk to be really interesting yesterday. I like that alt expo kind of leftist libertarian stuff a lot because that focuses more on the social aspects, mm-hmm. the communication and ethics that are required for us to right. live peacefully as libertarians.
Mm-hmm. I've always said that's really what car noise is.
Yeah.
Words. I've always said that's what sets us apart really from other political groups is that it is an ethics-based, you know, libertarianism is ethics-based, the zero aggression principle and or non-aggression principle or whatever, rather than just saying, well, I want this from the government, I want that from the government, I want my neighbors to do this, I want, you know, most politics is of that temper and not the other, not what is my responsibility and what, you know, and what are my true freedoms that are natural to me. But the interview is not with me.
I'll carry on, Ben.
So now you mentioned Doug Casey and going in that direction. Are there any other specific writers or personalities that have... Oh, and you mentioned Stefan Molyneux.
Yes.
Are there any others that are really stand out in your mind as influential to you?
What was most influential to me was the YouTube community.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the constant debate and interaction and self-regulation that goes on the internet community and the communities that are formed through that have really opened my eyes in terms of philosophy, epistemology, politics, economics. That's where I've really learned the most, actually. There's some really interesting characters on there who get no credit in the outside world, but I value their opinion much more than kind of a professor or like someone in a position of authority.
Yeah.
Because they've had to earn it by making good material.
And now you mentioned professors, and you're here in America, you know, oftentimes, I assume it's the same over there, but oftentimes people without a lot of formal education will make an excuse that, well, that high-minded stuff, they don't need to know what those stuffy professors, you know, and then someone with an education can say, well, that's just because you're uneducated and you don't know. But when you say that, you are an educated individual, so so you're not just the Scottish version of a hick, in other words. do you want to mention any of that?
Oh yes. Well, in the UK, I guess I consider myself to be quite middle class. Middle class in the UK is a different concept to middle class here. I think middle class here is anyone who has like a steady income and works for a living. The UK. I know it's if your parents are kind of skilled professionals or property owners, and you're pretty well off.
Then. Mm-hmm.
So I was privately educated. I went to good universities. Mm-hmm. Started out in Imperial College London doing chemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Finished at the University of Edinburgh. I worked for a large oil company for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently got a new job with a smaller one. I'm a process engineer. I work in Aberdeen, Scotland, the oil capital of Europe, it likes to call itself. And so I guess by most people's opinion, I'd be considered quite an educated person and kind of a skilled laborer.
Yeah.
But that doesn't... I don't really like the common definition of educated. Like, I work with a lot of people who are very well formally educated, but you take them off topic, and they don't really know very much at all.
Yeah.
I mean, where I'm from, like, outside of engineering, most other engineers, you know, they just want to, like, go out drinking, buy a sports car, and a nice house, and, you know, then they're satisfied, you know.
And follow whatever team is the...
Yeah, and watch, like, Manchester United on Saturday.
In the United States...
Oh, by the way, that's Kai with me on the podcast. I forgot to introduce her earlier.
In the United States, the college system is very—it's very difficult to be part of the college system and not be left liberal, hardcore Democrat. Is mm-hmm. that the same way in, you know, the UK?
The UK, it is. I mean, a lot of the student politics is very much kind of anti-profit, anti-business. I mean, I suppose there's ways around that. I mean, when I was at university, I never really got interested in that kind of thing. I became very apathetic with politics at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
Even though in the household, we'd always discuss it. You know, by the time I was in my mid to late teens, I'd kind of lost interest and lost all hope. So, I mean, you don't have to be any particular which way, but sometimes in certain social situations, it helps, and it's difficult to be another way,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And possibly... Oh, no, I was going to introduce... I thought Hannah was going to join us, but evidently not. She's just going to eat all the plums. We're podcasting here at Porkfest 2012 under very casual circumstances. Hi, grab a chair. Or there's bigger ones, too.
Sorry for now.
We're podcasting here at Porkfest 2012, and so you're hearing road noises, and people are welcome to just stop by, have a seat. Would you like water or beer? Or
good.
And Patrick's Patrick is with me from Scotland, and so what else is going on here at Porkfest that you enjoyed?
Mainly the conversations. I mean, last year I intended to attend a bunch of different panel discussions and talks, but I just end up getting tied down in really great conversations just around the campsite. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many intelligent people here. With a lot to say, but yeah, I mean, that's always the most memorable thing. And then when I leave, I try and catch up on the stuff I've missed on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, a lot of great campfire talks. I don't even know if I want to go into what I was discussing like last night. It was really off the wall and crazy and stuff I wouldn't really get to discuss in any other forum.
Yeah.
A couple of people, good friends of mine from last year, and then they both study psychology. Mm. So we were discussing meditation and kind of how trauma events can create dissociated personalities. Mm. There's one guy experimenting with that now and like intense meditation practice. Mm. I mean, you just get all sorts of people here, Ben. It's just great.
It's an interesting thing about liberty-oriented people. This is going to sound really elitist, you know? But typically, you're talking about more intelligent people who have stopped and really thought about things. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Education, maybe they have the education to match, maybe they don't. But what I found is just the general conversational level among liberty-oriented people is a much more intelligent type of communication than the average person, because the average, at least that I've encountered in the U.S., the average person conversation gets past weather or what's happening on their favorite TV show,
yeah,
and that's, you know, or what the main network news people are saying. That's about as far as they go with it. They don't think or question any further than that.
Yeah, it's true. I think social exclusion and ostracization for being different is a very powerful factor in that. I'm a great believer in the Maslow triangle.
Mm.
So, and most people, it's natural that they would want to satisfy their kind of needs for food, shelter, relationships,
mm-hmm.
Stability, and before they try and actualize their personal values.
Yeah.
I try not to blame them too much.
Mm-hmm.
I try my best to lead by example, practice nonviolent communication as much as possible, and open a lot of people up to it. Like recently, I've tried to get my friends along to some meditation classes.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get back, they're really interested about Porkfest and want to find out more and about the time I've had here. So,
yeah.
I know a lot of people here are very frustrated by the outside world, and we were talking last night, like, this is the one week where we get to be normal.
Yeah.
We feel normal.
Yeah.
And, like, the other 51 weeks of the year are kind of a bit of a fantasy land where we all kind of get by and feel a little bit awkward. But that's what it's like for every, I mean, we are the vanguard, and it's never easy for the vanguard. I mean, there's one quote, I mean, I don't particularly agree with being a patriot, but, you know, in the beginning, like, the patriot is shunned. I don't know quite how it goes, but in the end, everyone's a patriot.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it has its pros and cons. I mean, like, right, if this were a liberty event, when everyone believed in liberty, would we get all these personalities here right now?
Yeah.
So, it has its downsides, but we get Porkfest, which is special, and, you know, if liberty takes off, we can say we were part of it. And, you know, it might turn into some, like, giant corporate event sponsored by McDonald's in 30 years. You never know, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of what has happened with other, not liberty-oriented, but other things like this. I'm thinking specifically like the big gathering at Sturgis among bikers, that at first it was just real... It wasn't the disciplined thought level of liberty like we think of, but it was about freedom. You know, just the freedom for a lot of people to get together and just hang out and not be, not have to deal with the normal restrictions of society. And now it's practically scripted, you know.
Yeah.
And there are more law enforcement there. The whole purpose to go there was
to be away from that.
Yeah. And now it's an entirely corporate thing with law enforcement everywhere. And it used to be fairly calm in the sense of there would have been not that many reasons to arrest anybody because there was a self-policing that took place among bikers.
Yes.
And that's gone. And now they have to have cops there because the self-policing evaporated as the police came in.
And that, yeah.
And so now it's, you know, it's...
That's what's happening all over America and all over the UK, too.
But did government provocateurs instigate?
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
I mean, that's probably a big element of...
Yeah, they have to make a place for themselves. They have to justify their job.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, what was your name?
I'm Jay Noon.
Jay, good to meet you. I'm Ben.
Nice to meet you.
How you
this
doing,
is Kai.
Good.
Patrick.
Hello.
Yeah. Patrick. I think I've talked myself out, and I still have a show to do at 6.
Yeah, that's totally fine. I mean, I guess I could add to that by saying
2:30.
By saying that the music festivals are another great example of that, like Woodstock.
Yeah.
Burning Man.
Yeah, excellent example. That was to start. That was just a bunch of hippies on the beach. And now it's becoming a corporate thing. Are you aware of Burning Man? And
I am. Yeah.
You don't go to that, do you?
Well, a friend of mine from London actually was there last year.
Really?
So, yeah.
It's nearly impossible to get into it now.
Oh yeah.
This year they're doing a ticket lottery. You don't get to buy your ticket. You get to buy a raffle ticket, and they're raffling off a certain number of tickets to people. And if you've paid to buy a raffle ticket, you don't get your money back if you don't win.
Well, that's what creates a healthy gray market.
Right, yeah. And then you have to buy the ticket. And if you win a ticket, you have to buy the ticket, too. It's...
Wow.
Yeah, and I love it because, you know, this is the anti-capitalist gathering of socialists and money.
it's the rationing problem again, isn't it? Like, they never really worked out how to kind of fairly allocate goods to people who don't necessarily have the money to pay for them.
Yeah. And tickets are ridiculously expensive.
There's room for expansion here.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can see it this year as well. I mean, last year there was much more of a party atmosphere. You know, liquor was a lot more freely available. But I think there was an NPR story on here where apparently, so I've heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but a reporter came here and bought liquor from a 9-year-old girl. So there's going to be the focus on it as it grows. And, you know, maybe we need to start our own port fest or something.
Yeah. And there's and we were talking about this yesterday, within Porkfest, which is not necessarily anarchy, it's a blend of just liberty people, Ron Paul supporters,
Gary
Johnson supporter. It's a wide variety of people, but within this, there's sort of a partially anarchical, sort of a subgroup that's doing their own miniature pork fest that's called Alt Expo, which is sort of a unauthorized underground pork fest inside Pork Fest.
Mm.
I didn't realize that was happening until somebody came by and let us know about it.
And it's had a excellent. Whole schedule of alternative events that were happening.
Mm. I mean, there's room for everyone here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now we're all pushing in the same direction. I mean, the day I'm arguing with a constitutionalist to decrease the size of government, and he's arguing to increase the size of government, will be a good day.
Yeah.
Folks, I want to talk to you about Survival Gear Bags. Survival Gear Bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at badquaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And what you heard prior to that was the interview with Patrick at Porkfest 2012. If you could hear in the background, Kai was with us there at the camp spot, and other people came and went. And there at the end, Jay, I think he called himself Noon. He spelled it No One, Jay No One, but I think he pronounced it Noon or Newen. Anyway, Jay joined us, and that was his voice that you heard coming in there, the deeper voice. And I have an entire interview with him. He is the person I've been teasing about his interview for a couple weeks now. He is the sovereign citizen that I was talking about, if you've heard me on other podcasts. I'm giving a disclaimer here, as always. I don't support the sovereign citizen movement, and I think there's some serious flaws in their message. But Jay was so serious and so intent and so concerned about the situation that he was in, and he was so passionate about his situation that I decided not only would I not confront him and try to, convince him of my opinion on the sovereign citizen movement, I thought it would be better served if I let him really explain himself so that my listeners could get a better understanding of the way the sovereign citizen people think. And it's not my intention to, to tear him down or to tear the sovereign citizen movement down or to anything like that. But when I play that interview with Jay, and I'm not going to do it today, I have other topics for today. I'll play that on another podcast. But when I do, it's not for the purpose of tearing them down or tearing Jay down. Really, it's important to understand where these people are coming from, see if we can find the flaw in what they believe, and maybe even find a way to help them to maybe improve the way that they're fighting the battle they're fighting. Because, honestly, their enemy is our enemy. The problem is, it's very much like other aspects of the liberty movement. You look at it and you say, okay, well, you recognize the enemy, and what is it that you're doing to fight that enemy? And the sovereign citizen folks have a tendency to look at the people like me and think I'm not really doing anything. I'm not really, I'm part of the problem. I'm not part of the answer because I'm not doing the things that they're doing. And so my purpose in allowing Jay the time to really express himself like this, and my purpose in not contradicting him or whatever, was so that I could really have the opportunity to really get inside his head and find out how these people think and understand them a little bit better. And I did. This is Jay is the first sovereign citizen that I've ever met in person and really had a chance to talk to and listen to them and understand where they were coming from. So again, I'm going to play that on that whole interview with Jay on a future podcast. I'm not going to cut any out. I'm going to let him completely express himself, explain the situation that he's in, and how he's handling it and how he's battling the state and so forth. And then in future episodes, we can go over that in more depth and see if we can't, I don't know, maybe I can learn something from them, but also maybe I can find a way to understand them better and maybe work towards helping them achieve the goal that they want, which is, you know, liberty. I mean, that's what we're all after, whether or not we're on the right path towards achieving it. You know, we're all here trying to help each other refine the way this battle is taking place. So, you know, if I can learn something from the sovereign citizen people, then I certainly want to do that. There's aspects of what they're doing that I, that I have problems with, but we'll get into that at some time. Okay, so today, getting to the real topic here, today I did want to go over some of the stuff that I was talking about in yesterday's podcast. I started talking about identification, friend or foe, and I had actually, I began looking at the topic. One of the listeners suggested I take a look at a video, and then also suggested the topic of identification, friend or foe. And I mentioned that on yesterday's podcast. And I did watch the video, and I started looking at this, and I started seeing within the concept of identification, friend or foe. Maybe I should just recap that really quick in case somebody's listening that didn't hear yesterday. Identification, friend or foe, or IFF, is the age-old process of, you know, you have a watchman or you have a night guard or whatever guarding the camp, or even a day guard, I suppose. You have a guard guarding the camp, and someone is approaching. So as they're approaching, the guard gives a challenge, you know, a halt, who goes there, that kind of a thing, friend or foe. And the person approaching then would be expected to give an appropriate response to this challenge. So, for instance, if you say, halt, what is the password? And then if they're a friend, they would know that password, and they would say, you know, Australopithecus. Well, probably not, but anyway. And then, so if that's the password of the day, then you let them enter, and so you have had this identification of whether they're friend or foe by challenging them and then having them return the challenge with the correct message. And this could also be done with, you know, challenging them for their papers. Perhaps they have letters or identification of some kind. It's all in the same concept. So that's what the ancient version of IFF was. And then the Germans put a new twist on this just before World War II. They figured out how to take a radar sending unit mounted, you know, on the ground, and send out a message, and they figured out how to put a radar sending and receiving unit in airplanes so that when a message would be sent from the ground radar unit, the incoming airplane would receive that message and automatically send out a response to that message. So you still have the challenge and response messages, but they're taking place through radar, and you would have different settings on the receivers and on the sending units, so that, you know, according to orders, they would be set to different settings, so that today it might be one frequency with a specific challenge and another frequency with an answer to that challenge, but then tomorrow they may switch that, and there may be, you know, a different send challenge and a different receive challenge. So this way you could keep it, you know, keep moving it around as orders required, and keep the, you know, the secret password, so to speak, would be safe day after day like that. The problem with this, and it worked very well in theory, to identify the German planes to the German ground people so they wouldn't shoot at their own planes, you know. And this worked really well in theory, but the problem was that the British broke the code almost right away, which meant that it was actually more harmful to the Germans than it was good, because they still thought that the code worked, But in fact, every time they sent out the thing, the message, the British could triangulate and figure out exactly where the German airplanes were and go after them and shoot them down. So, unfortunately, the code was broken almost as fast as it was put up. And what this created for the Germans was a false sense of security that put their flyers at risk beyond even what they could understand, because, of course, they didn't know the code was broken and they didn't know it was compromised. And I said yesterday that the Liberty Movement, our code has been compromised. There are lots of people out there that know the magic words. They know how to say Federal Reserve, Liberty, Ron Paul. They know these key words to say, and all further challenges to them cease. So we have, you know, to pick on people. I was picking on people yesterday. I suppose I can pick on people today. Back in 2008, the Libertarian Party actually had Bob Barr as their Libertarian candidate for president. Here's former CIA, former hardcore conservative, former, you know, voted for the Patriot Act, and I know it's, oh, but he put limits on the Patriot Act. Yeah, that worked out well, didn't it? Compromising under the excuse that you're just trying to control something, that really works well, doesn't it? Anyway, you know, so our camp has been compromised, and it's really easy to compromise the Libertarian camp because we so trust in these words and these phrases that we think, you know, most people, if you talk to most people about the Federal Reserve, they have no idea what you're talking about. If you talk to most people about, you know, a zero aggression principle, they have no idea what you're talking about. So when we bump into somebody who knows these catchphrases, we really tend to just accept them at face value and let them walk right in among us. And, you know, going back to picking on the Libertarian Party again, Gary Johnson is a perfect example of this. And I say this because last night I got called by the Libertarian Party wanting me to give them money to support Gary Johnson for president. This is after, you know, Gary Johnson goes on the Bob Wenzel show and lies to him about whether or not he read Rothbard. He gets caught up in the lie, then has an attitude with Bob Wenzel when Bob Wenzel catches him in the lie. Then Bob gives him several opportunities to talk his way out of it, but instead Gary Johnson just does the typical politician trick and, you know, tries to change the subject and talk about what the ACLU, how the ACLU ranks him. Well, why would we care about that? You know, if you're saying that you're well acquainted with the Mises Institute and that you read Rothbard, and then it turns out you don't know anything about Austrian economics, you don't know anything about Mises, you've never read any Rothbard, never heard of Henry Hazlitt. Now, that's fine. You know, like Rothbard said, economics is a, I can't remember what he called it, a dull or a dreary science or something like that. And it's not necessary for everybody to understand Austrian economics to be a libertarian. But if you don't understand Austrian economics, don't go on an interview with a world-famous economist and lie about it and pretend you do know about economics. You know, be honest and just say, well, I don't, you know, Bob, I don't really know that much about economics, but here's what I did as governor. If Gary Johnson had done that, I would have been perfectly comfortable with him, but he didn't. He goes on an economist's podcast for an interview and then lies about how much he knows about economics. And that's who the Libertarian Party has brought into their camp and is holding up for the world to see as a libertarian. So what's libertarian about Gary Johnson? Well, he's pro-pot. Well, that doesn't make him libertarian. The guy next door to me is pro-pot. He's not a libertarian. The guy across the street from me is pro-pot. He's not a libertarian. I'm against pot, and I am a libertarian. I don't want anything to do with the stuff. I don't use it. I don't have it in my house. I don't have anything to do with it. But I'm a libertarian, and they're not. And why is that? Because I understand the zero aggression principle, and I strive towards it. That's my goal, is to bring the bring the zero aggression principle into my life in as many ways as possible. Therefore, I'm a libertarian. And you start talking, you know, Bob Wenzel starts talking to Gary Johnson, and instead the guy wants to play politics, and he wants to lie, and he wants to try to, you know, change the subject, and he wants to try to pretend that he's something he's not. Well, we've allowed people like this to come in among us. A conservative like Gary Johnson can put on the mantle of a libertarian, and nobody challenges him. They just bring him right on in, make him the, you know, because, oh, well, he's cool, he's dashing, he's athletic, he climbed Mount Everest, he, not parachutes, what is it, paraglides? I don't know, whatever it is. Anyway, he's athletic, whatever. So we just accept him. Just like with Bob Barr, you know, Bob Barr had about the worst record that you could possibly have to try to convince somebody that you're a libertarian. And yet he walked right into the control of the Libertarian Party. How does that take place? And the answer is because our code is broken. We can't rely, just like the Germans had their code broken, and then they relied on it anyway because they didn't understand the dangers. And I mentioned yesterday in the podcast about the Japanese. Their code in communications, it was different than it was in a IFF code, but their secret communication code had been compromised by the U.S. intelligence before World War II, and so the U.S. knew for a fact that when they were going to attack Pearl Harbor, how they were going to attack it, how long they'd been planning it. They knew all this stuff, and the Japanese walked essentially into the worst kind of a trap because they thought they were completely disabling the American Navy, when in fact all they were doing is blowing up a bunch of ships that wouldn't be used in a modern war anyway. All the aircraft carriers and the whole aircraft carrier support fleets were out at sea where they were safe, very conveniently moved because the U.S. government knew that the attack was going to take place. So literally, the FDR administration baited the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor by using their own compromised intelligence, and then sacrificed all those sailors and Marines and so forth in Pearl Harbor just to get the excuse to go into the war. And had the Japanese known that, you know, maybe they wouldn't have gone into Pearl Harbor at all. Maybe they would have been wise enough to say, look, we're getting set up here. We need to back off and look at this. But they didn't. And so we can learn lessons from history like this. We can look at things and say, you know, just because someone has the magic words, just because they know the secret handshake, or they've got a special ring on, you know, or they've got a Ron Paul bumper sticker, this doesn't necessarily mean that they understand the concepts of liberty. This doesn't necessarily mean that they're trying to follow the zero aggression principle. It could just mean that they want to be part of the club, because being libertarian is cool right now. You know, all the hip cats want to be libertarians right now, because we're the happening thing. Fall back to some 60s lingo there. But the fact is that it doesn't matter how much these people want to wave the libertarian banner and use all the magic words, if their actions are not following through with their words, then their words are just noise. Their words are just deception. Okay, I'm going to break off, and we're going to hit our second commercial break, and I'll be right back in 30 seconds with some more. Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And for the last segment of today's podcast, I want to play a recording from last year. And if you've heard this before, just stick with it. It's fairly short. It's about 15 minutes long. But it, I think it's worth re-listening to again. And the reason I'm playing it today specifically is because the statements that I made yesterday regarding the that the Constitution is our problem. You know, I was talking about the challenge aspect of the IFF, or the Identification Friend or Foe. In the challenge, somebody might say, well, what do you think about the Constitution? And like I said yesterday, well, there's really no right answer there, because, you know, there are people in the liberty movement who still believe that the Constitution is a salvageable thing, that if we could just get back to the Constitution, everything would be okay. And then there are others of us who think the Constitution is the problem. But this is not a litmus test for libertarians. It's more of a, what level of understanding are you at? So, you know, to ask someone, like I was picking on Gary Johnson there, to ask Gary Johnson about the Constitution, you would probably get a fairly predictable answer. But the problem is that answer would be useless, because it wouldn't really address whether or not Gary Johnson understands the zero aggression principle and is moving towards it or not. So in this last segment, give a listen to this article that I wrote last year titled To Establish Justice. And I think it'll be well worth your time. So here we go. Here's the article.
BadQuaker.com audio article for Thursday, June 30th, 2011, To Establish Justice. Quote, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. End quote. The Preamble of the Constitution of the United States. The preamble is the statement that explains the purpose of the federal government of the United States and the purpose of its Constitution. Within the body of this document, it legally authorized the federal government of the United States to tax and maintain a monopoly of federal power within the geographic borders of the national state. Additionally, it purports to limit the powers of said federal government and protect the rights of individuals. If the federal government that maintains a monopoly of power within the geographic borders of the United States and functions as a national state accomplishes the stated purposes of that preamble, then no sane and honest person living within those borders should have grounds to object to being governed by that national state. The glaring question then becomes, is that national state accomplishing its purported purpose as outlined by that preamble in a competent manner that justifies its continued existence? To establish justice and ensure domestic tranquility. The preamble that establishes the Constitution and authorizes the existence of the state presents a false dichotomy. Domestic tranquility can only exist where there is justice. Where there is no justice, revolution is a guaranteed result at some point. If carefully orchestrated and maintained, false justice can be used to fool the masses into believing justice exists. But this will only work temporarily and will result in a radically more unstable reaction by the masses once the lie is exposed. Therefore, domestic tranquility cannot be separated from justice. To say you provide justice and domestic tranquility is like saying you provide water and wet. So then, we begin to see either an incompetent understanding of the subject at hand by the framers of the Constitution, or the beginning of the deception of the American public. Justice. Other than cases where mental illness is a factor, humans tend to harm each other under three sets of circumstances. one of which is war, and I will not cover that topic at this time. In this article, I intend to look at the other two of those sets of circumstances and propose questions as to whether or not the state is accomplishing its claim of, quote, establishing justice. I will attempt to show that the state has not and cannot establish justice, since the state itself is based on injustice and is incapable of establishing or maintaining justice. Two ways sane humans harm each other. 1. Accident. An accident, by its very definition, is not planned nor intended. Therefore, it's an injustice to treat an accident the same as an intentional act. When an accident occurs, there must be a victim or victims, and there must be a responsible party or parties. If a dispute exists over the damages, a neutral third party must be involved to judge the facts and determine an equitable settlement in order for justice to take place. For example, let's say Bill owns a hot dog stand. Tom shows up one day to buy a hot dog. After having purchased the hot dog, Tom bites into it, hitting a hard object and breaking a tooth. It's determined that the object was a small rock. One scenario could be that Bill had stored his big umbrella on the ground overnight, and gravel inadvertently got lodged in the fabric. Then Bill was not careful enough when he set up his hot dog stand that day, and allowed gravel to fall into the hot dog chili mix. So then, due to Bill's lack of attention, Tom has a broken tooth. Assuming there is a dispute, once blame is established, a judge would need to determine the extent of the damage and the path of compensation. The value of Tom's tooth, along with compensation to cover his pain and inconvenience, would need to be determined, along with a reasonable way for Bill to pay that compensation. Additionally, a determination would need be made as to who pays for the judging process. If we change the scenario and we find out that gravel fell in the chili at the chili factory because of the factory's slack standards, both Tom and Bill may have a case against the chili factory owner, since Tom's tooth is damaged and Bill's business may be damaged. 2. Aggression. An aggression is an intentional act by a person or persons resulting in the violation or damage of the property of other person or persons. In order for justice to take place, damages must be determined and compensated, and a punishment must be determined that is suitable to the victim or, in case of death, the victim's heir. And if investigation and or judgment are needed to resolve any disputes resulting from the aggression, the aggressor must carry the burden of the expenses involved. Using the example above, if it's determined that Bill intended to harm Tom by placing a gravel in his food, justice cannot be served until Tom is not only compensated for the broken tooth, but also allowed to avenge the assault. If Bill feels Tom's vengeance and or compensation is excessive, an arbitrator may be employed by Bill to seek a more suitable solution that still satisfies Tom. If it's determined that the chili factory owner placed the gravel in the chili in order to damage Bill's hot dog stand business, Tom and Bill have a grievance with the chili factory owner. Here we can see the difference between an act of negligence and a criminal act of aggression. Negligence resulting in accidental damages should be justifiably compensated for, while criminal acts must be both compensated for and punished. This would be a good spot in the article to repeat the question. Is this national state accomplishing its purported purpose as outlined by the preamble in a competent manner that justifies its continued existence? Keep in mind, we have determined that without genuine justice, there cannot be an enduring domestic tranquility, and we have established that treating an accident as if it were an act of aggression is in itself an injustice. During 2010, my wife and I had the great pleasure of driving our motorhome from Ohio to Missouri, where we visited my wife's family. During that trip, we passed through Illinois, where we observed a barrage of warning signs along the highway threatening, hit a worker, 10,000 fine, 14 years jail. For practical purposes, let's examine if this version of justice protects highway workers by asking, why would a person strike a highway worker with their motor vehicle? If the answer to that question involves motivations of malice and or aggression, there may be some logic to displaying such a threat. Malice or aggression would indicate forethought and planning, and that would indicate that the individual might weigh the cost of being caught. But it's ridiculously unlikely that a person would plan an assault or murder by publicly running down a highway worker. And if someone did such a thing, assault and murder are already against the law. It's far more likely that a highway worker is placed by the state in one of the most dangerous positions a person can find themselves in North America, and they're expected to do this day after day, mostly during peak traffic hours. Then, when a worker is struck by a motor vehicle, it's almost certain to be a dreadful accident that the motorist would have never chosen to be involved in. I cannot imagine a situation where a motorist is driving along a highway, contemplating hitting a road worker, but is suddenly deterred by a sign threatening a $10,000 fine and 14 years imprisonment. The absurdity of this should be blatantly obvious to everyone seeing these signs, but sadly, due to generations of brainwashing, it's not obvious, and I must point it out. For a comparison to our 14-year sentence for accidentally striking a person who stands inches out of traffic on a busy highway at rush hour, let's look at some numbers from the federal government. Average sentences per offense and average time served. Murder, 18 years, time served, 9 years. Rape, 8.6 years, time served, 4.3 years. Aggravated assault, 3 years, time served, 18 months. We can see from this data that punishing a motorist with a 14-year sentence for an accident is the opposite of justice. Also, the fine of $10,000 is a somewhat silly, arbitrary punishment that has no logical connection to the act of accidentally striking someone with a car. It's not meant as a compensation to the victim or the victim's family. It's simply an inappropriate method of revenue collection by the state over a tragic accident. A more logical route to justice could be to examine the individual specifics of each case and have a neutral arbitrator work with the victim or the victim's heirs in determining guilt and compensation, then determining if the driver is competent to continue driving. Part of the guilt determination process would be to discover the reason the worker was inches away from moving traffic. Since the state owns the roads and either employs the worker or contracts the employment of the worker, the state must be at least partly responsible for placing the worker in such a position. However, as the reader well knows, it simply doesn't work that way. The state owns the highway, designed the highway, places workers in harm's way, determines the law, judges the driver, determines the sentence, doles out the punishment, collects the fine, and charges non-interested third parties and the victim with the taxes to pay for the whole process. So assuming the victim survives, the victim will actually pay for the incarceration of the motorist. There is no aspect of this process that can rightfully be called justice. Oh, but wait, you say. You're cherry-picking your argument, you say. Most of the criminal justice system works in America, you say. This is just one oddity, you say. To this, I would counter that you have been deceived, and you only see that which the state wants you to see. There is no aspect of the United States justice system that has the capacity to determine or the ability to hand out justice. It is a system that makes up its own laws, judges its own laws, enforces its own laws, profits from its own laws and answers only to itself for its own laws. It does so while extracting its primary funding forcibly from people who are not and have never been accused of a crime. Let's drift back to that motorhome trip, cruising down Highway I-70, moments before leaving the state of Illinois. My wife was behind the wheel as we motored along, and I contemplated how badly the road was maintained, how illogically it was plotted through and around the river crossings at St. Louis, and what a ridiculous thing it was to still be using highway designs invented in 1930s Nazi Germany. But just then, my wife snapped me out of my daydream with a warning of a nasty swerve and a bump ahead, which caused several odd objects to go flying around the motorhome, one of which was a DVD of the TV series Breaking Bad. I grabbed the DVD before it could bounce its way into some inconvenient spot, and was instantly reminded again of the absurdity of the 14-year, $10,000 fine for striking a road worker. You see, the warning on the DVD threatened me with a $250,000 fine for copying this TV show. So, for the simple act of making a copy of a plastic disc coated with ones and zeros, I could be labeled a, quote, pirate and fined $250,000 to establish justice and ensure domestic tranquility. So then, is this national state accomplishing its purported purpose as outlined by that preamble in a competent manner that justifies its continued existence? Once again, it is impossible for the state to establish justice because the state can only exist by the use of theft, lies, and aggression. The state has no mechanism to create something it is void of. This can already be seen on the Mexico-U.S. border, and it will only get worse. Lawlessness will engulf the cities of the U.S. and Canada, as it is already engulfing the cities of Mexico. Each step the state takes to, quote, get tough will make the situation worse, since the state itself is simply a powerful crime gang. In time, the Mexican and Canadian governments will capitulate to their crime lords in D.C., and the fact that there is but one state in North America will become too obvious to even bother denying. Rather than delivering on its promise of justice and domestic tranquility, the state will use fear as a tactic to divide the masses. The state will emphasize the cultural differences and focus even more of its efforts into convincing people that other people are the problem and only the state can keep them safe. Over and over, our fellow men will be demonized as the state desperately tries to paint itself as our savior. Punishment for the slightest infractions will be more and more harsh as this false god produces false justice. In the years ahead, before the eyes of most people in North America begin to see the institutionalized tyranny that those in control of governments are pouring out under the guise of law and justice, domestic tranquility will be nothing but a memory. This process will continue until the time comes that people realize that the source of the problem is in their masters who tax them and keep them in fear of their neighbors while maintaining those monopolies of power. As long as we trust the lies of the state and fear our neighbors more than our masters, the power of the state will grow and the injustices will get worse. Eventually, it will be obvious that the state has failed at establishing justice, and domestic tranquility will be redefined to mean a complete police state. Welfare has already been redefined to mean government rations, and defense now means never-ending foreign war. The blessings of liberty have become permission slips when the state allows us to open an authorized business, grow authorized plants, drive authorized cars to authorized employment and keep an authorized amount of what we earn. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.